Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
President Obama says the world must be more prepared for Ebola-like outbreaks, and the Zambian vice president denies President Sata is treated in New York. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. U.S. President Barack Obama is calling for greater readiness to handle biological threats like the Ebola outbreak that has killed nearly 3,000 people in West Africa. The president promoted a strategy he summed up as prevent, detect, and respond.
Afghan security officials say...
He said the U.S. will help other nations develop resources such as rapid response teams so lives can be saved when outbreaks happen in the future. His comments come a day after he spoke at the United Nations calling for a stronger international response to the Ebola epidemic. Zambia's vice president is disputing reports that President Michael Sata has fallen ill and received a medical treatment in New York. Mr. Sata did not address the United Nations General Assembly as planned on Wednesday, and New York police told VOA that he was treated at his hotel Thursday by doctors with the U.S. State Department. However, the Zambian vice president told his country's parliament today that his president's health is entirely normal. Top diplomats from the United States, the European Union, and the EU foreign policy chief met Thursday in New York, where the UN General Assembly is being held. However, it's not clear if Tehran's nuclear talks have made any progress. A senior U.S. official told VOA that they would take stock of the work that has been done this week. This is VOA News. The UN Refugee Agency says the number of people seeking asylum in industrialized nations has risen by nearly a quarter, most of the increase driven by wars in Iraq and Syria. The UNHCR says in a report released today that some 330,700 people sought refugee status during the first 6 months of this year, a 24% increase from the same period in 2013. The agency says if the trend continues, the 2014 total could reach 700,000. That's the highest total for industrialized countries in 20 years. American fighter jets and drones and other aircraft pounded Islamic State targets in Iraq and Syria today as Britain, Denmark, and Belgium joined the U.S.-led coalition fighting the group. The U.S. Central Command says four Islamic State tanks were destroyed in Syria's Deir al-Zor province. A group monitoring the war in Syria said today that oil facilities were the apparent target of the overnight strikes in Deir al-Zor. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said a command center for the Islamic State group was also hit. A crew of astronauts from Russia and the United States docked safely today at the International Space Station. The Russian Soyuz spacecraft left from the Baikonur launch facility in Kazakhstan Thursday, carrying into orbit two astronauts from Russia and one U.S. astronaut. The crew will stay on the ISS for a six-month deployment, joining a team of three other astronauts already on board. The U.S. economy grew at its fastest pace in more than 2 years from April through June, and a positive sign for growth for the rest of the year. The Commerce Department today raised its estimate for the gross domestic product growth in the second quarter to an annual rate of 4.6%. The new figure is up from last month's 4.2% estimate, and reflects improvements in business spending and exports. Chinese state media now say 50 people were killed during recent unrest in the violence-ridden far west region of Xinjiang. Previously, officials said only two people died in last Sunday's violence in Lutai County, southwest of the region's capital of Urumqi. The Taishan News Portal provided more details today, saying bombs exploded at two police stations and two stores, killing four police officers and six civilians. India's foreign minister says India and China have resolved a tense two-week military border standoff in the northern Himalayan region. The foreign minister said today that he met after meeting with his Chinese counterpart in New York that Chinese troops would begin withdrawing today. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight. From the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The World Health Organization reports that a couple of promising anti-Ebola vaccines may be ready for use in heavily affected West African countries early next year. WHO says work on other potentially life-saving experimental therapies is also underway.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from WHO headquarters in Geneva. We'll have more on this story coming up. Also, health officials say fear of Ebola in West Africa could prevent people from getting treatment for malaria. The International Arms Trade Treaty soon becomes law, and we'll hear more from African presidents attending the UN General Assembly in New York. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Nigeria, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, public health specialists say they're worried that fear of Ebola in West Africa will prevent people from getting treatment for malaria. The World Health Organization estimates about 3,000 people have died from Ebola so far this year in five countries. Typically, malaria kills around 100,000 West Africans each year. But that number could be much higher next year if people don't receive medication. Jimmy Whitworth, the director of Population Health for Britain's Wellcome Trust, warns malaria could kill around 400,000 people next year in Ebola-hit countries. He says deaths from diarrhea and pneumonia, which are some of the biggest killers of children in sub-Saharan Africa, will also rise. Mortality could also increase among women in childbirth and children not receiving immunizations for diphtheria, polio, and tuberculosis. UNICEF says that 9,000 health kits have arrived in Liberia, the hardest hit country. The kits contain gowns, plastic gloves, and masks, soap, and chlorine. They will be used in Ebola care centers and in communities to safely care for those who fall ill. The kits are provided by the U.S. Agency for International Development. It plans to distribute kits to more than 400,000 Liberian families as well. A UNICEF spokesman says the biggest priority in the epidemic is to expand the number of Ebola care centers. While the World Health Organization says promising Ebola vaccines may be ready for use in West African countries early next year, the WHO says work on other potentially life-saving experimental therapies is also underway. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The Ebola epidemic is ravaging parts of West Africa. The World Health Organization considers it the most severe public health emergency in the world today. But there are no vaccines or medicines to prevent or cure this disease, which is killing about 50% of people it infects. Given this emergency, WHO experts have agreed it is ethically acceptable to use experimental medicines and vaccines to try to combat Ebola. Work is underway to assess the safety of several possible vaccines. WHO Assistant Director General Marie-Paul Kini says results from these safety tests will be known by the end of the year, and if all goes well, two candidate vaccines might start to be used in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia in early January.
This will not be mass vaccination campaign, let's be clear about that, because the quantity of vaccine which will be available doesn't make this possible. But we will discuss next week with experts what would be the best target in terms of the first person to be offered the vaccine. This would be under informed consent. Of course, this vaccine, none of the vaccine would be licensed. So this is part of a sort of emergency or compassionate use that was described in the and discussed with experts.
Dr. Kini tells VOA healthcare and frontline workers are being considered as candidates for the vaccines. She adds the vaccines might also be offered to contacts of people known to have Ebola, depending on how many doses are available.
What we will have to do very soon is start working with the community and have community mobilization. You know that there is the situation, the political situation is quite unstable. The population are very vulnerable. There is some violence. They don't understand what is happening. So it is also, it will be very important that the community, through the community leaders, are brought on board.
Dr. Keeney says there is growing interest in the use of safe whole blood or plasma transfusions from recovered Ebola patients to treat those who are sick. She says not enough people have been treated with this therapy to know whether it is effective. However, she says there is anecdotal evidence of people having survived because of this treatment.
But there is a lot of enthusiasm indeed, because this is something which is available on site. This is something where the African population don't have to wait for anybody else to develop it for them. So this is why there is a lot of enthusiasm.
Dr. Keeney says volunteer donors will have to be screened to make sure their blood is free of the Ebola virus. She says these tests are routinely used in the field. WHO reports 6,242 people are infected with Ebola, including more than 2,900 killed. It says these figures are far greater than those from all previous Ebola outbreaks combined. Yet it warns even these large figures vastly underestimate the true scale of the epidemic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. In the wake of the devastation of West African healthcare systems by the Ebola virus epidemic, one country has been riding a wave of progress in the healthcare field over the past 10 years. The Results for Development Institute, a nonprofit organization, says Ghana is a rising star for universal health coverage in Africa. Ghana will be highlighted at the third Global Symposium on Health Systems Research in Cape Town, South Africa, next week. Its National Health Insurance Scheme, NHIS, is a prominent model for how to pay for health care. Nathan Blanchett is a senior program officer at Results for Development Institute in Washington. He described how Ghana's health care system advanced from being a very harsh system for those who could not pay.
Ghana has been undergoing a lot of changes in how it finances and organizes its health care system, really since it gained independence in 1957. Most recently, in the 1990s, there was a lot of controversy over how to pay for health care. And it became a very, not just controversial, but also very personal and even heartbreaking issue for many Ghanaians. There were some extreme cases where, because of increasing user fees for health services, you even had some patients being detained, even handcuffed to hospital beds before they could pay their bills. In 2003, Ghana launched its National Health Insurance Scheme, and over the past 10 years has made really remarkable progress towards universal health coverage.
Could you give us some examples of this progress that has been made?
First of all, the National Health Insurance Scheme is a really big deal in what it is trying to do. It is trying to cover all Ghanaians, trying to provide all Ghanaians with the same very generous and comprehensive package of benefits, and pay for that package of benefits almost entirely through taxes that are prepaid. This is a very big change from what existed previously in Ghana. Through the past 10 years, they have now enrolled about one-third of their population. That's 10 million out of about 25. They have dramatically increased the use of healthcare services. That's probably the biggest success. And they have improved the financial risk protection that people get from having health insurance for many. But despite these big progresses, there's really a lot of challenges left. And they're now working through some of the big challenges that come from having set up this very good system, but it's a system that comes with a lot of challenges that they'll be working on for a long time.
What are some of those big challenges that Ghana is facing right now?
Well, the first is enrolling everybody. The idea of universal health coverage is that everybody can access the health care they need basically without going broke. Right now, they are still have not enrolled about two-thirds of the population. So increasing coverage is one big challenge. The next one is financial sustainability. So the NHIS, when it started, was really a big bang, and it got a lot of really tough things right, but it definitely created financial sustainability challenges. It's a very generous package of services. There's no costs to the users when they use healthcare, and the NHIS has seen its cost that it has to pay out for claims increasing a lot, and that is clearly causing financial sustainability problems that they are now trying to work on.
Where is the pool of money coming from?
That's a great question, Kim, and it's one of the things that makes Ghana's scheme so remarkable and so unique in the African context, too. It's almost all coming from prepaid taxes. About 70% of the revenues come from a 2.5% addition to the value-added tax on goods and services that Ghana has. That was a huge thing that they implemented to start this plan. Another part comes from a portion of payroll taxes, and then only a very small part, about 5% of revenues, come from premiums that individuals pay.
The Ebola crisis is having a devastating effect on healthcare systems in the countries being affected by the virus right now, those in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. So how is Ghana's NHIS healthcare system, how will it work if they should experience a similar crisis?
I see Ebola really as a major health system failure. It's the kind of thing that gets out of control when you have very weak health systems. So the first point is that, you know, NHIS is really about strengthening Ghana's health system, and countries all over the world have really gotten on board with this idea that health systems matter and they need to be strengthened. And Ghana is one of the leaders in Africa for that. Now, the connection between NHIS right now and Ebola, there's not much of a connection right now, but over time, having something like NHIS, which increases people's access to care, improves especially the lower levels and primary health care, should lead to much faster detection of something like Ebola. And hopefully in the future, as systems are strengthened, you would not have a disease like that get so out of control as it is now.
That was Nathan Blanchett, a senior program officer at Results for Development Institute. He spoke with me in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At 17 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Public health specialists worry that fear of Ebola in West Africa will prevent people from getting treatment for malaria. And Ghana has been riding a wave of progress in the healthcare field with their national health insurance scheme. And of course, we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237. The 90-day countdown has begun for the arms trade treaty to enter into force. That's because more countries ratified the treaty yesterday, bringing the overall total so far to 53. The convention regulates the international trade in conventional arms, from small arms to battle tanks, combat aircraft, and warships. The treaty is now scheduled to take effect in December, 18 months after the first signatures in June 2013. Anna McDonald is director of the Control Arms Coalition. From New York, she spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about how the treaty will regulate arms sales.
The Arms Trade Treaty will work by requiring every government to make a risk assessment on arms that are moving in or out of their territory. So they will have to make the risk assessment based on criteria on will the arms be misused for human rights abuses? Do they risk being diverted? Could they be used in violations of humanitarian law? And if the answer is yes, then they must not authorize that transfer. If it's properly implemented, the Arms Trade Treaty can really help reduce the number of arms that flow from the legal licit trade into the illicit trade.
But the illicit trade is such a big business worldwide. Will it really have a major impact on it?
To stop so many arms being in the illicit trade, we first of all have to regulate the licit trade, the legal trade. And that's been the problem in the past, that there are simply no global regulations on the conventional arms trade, everything from big weapons down to small arms and ammunition. So this is a first step, and governments have to put into place now the requirements of the treaty. But yesterday, we saw more than 50 governments ratify the treaty at the United Nations. That means it will now enter in into force in 90 days' time, so it'll become international law. Its provisions become binding, and the momentum behind it remains very high. A lot of governments, particularly in Africa, really want this treaty to work.
Why so? Why in Africa?
Because of the problem of arms flooding into some of the world's worst conflict zones, because of the unregulated supply of arms, particularly ammunition, that is really fueling so many atrocities, so many volatile areas and so many conflicts. They're seeing the arms trade treaty as a first step to try to help reduce some of those conflicts, some of those worst situations. It's not a panacea for solving armed violence, but it can make a really important contribution. There are less ratifications from Africa at the moment, which isn't because they don't want to ratify the treaty. It's because they require some technical assistance. They require some financial assistance to be able to do it. So we kind of need the donor countries to step up and support some of the less resourced countries as they try to implement this treaty and as they try to put its provisions in place.
Do you believe it would affect the number of civilian casualties in these conflicts?
Yes. I mean, the majority of casualties these days are civilians in conflict. And we have heard the voices of so many people around the world calling for this treaty, calling for a halt to the violence. Please stop so many weapons flooding into our communities. So this is what so many communities and civil society organizations that we work with in Africa want to see happening. They want to see a reduction to the amount of violence and disruption in their communities.
So let's talk about the treaty entering into force. It enters into force in December, I believe. What exactly does that mean?
It means that it becomes international law and its provisions are then binding on all the countries that have ratified it, but also because it now exists, or it will exist, as international law. It provides a strong deterrent from all countries, even those that are not signatories to the treaty. And that's really important because while we want to see all countries sign and ratify this treaty, we know that's going to take time. And there are some countries that may not sign it for a very long time, but that doesn't mean they won't be affected by it. We've seen this happen with other treaties too, whereby even countries that don't sign onto a treaty find themselves affected by its provisions. The pressure of not violating the treaty becomes much higher. The political cost of violating the treaty is something that governments don't want to willingly be seen to undertake. And also, because the arms trade is such a global business, if a lot of countries sign and ratify this treaty, it does start clamping down on the loopholes that exist. It does make it harder even for non-signatory governments to so easily get their hands on so much arms and ammunition.
What are the major countries that have not signed on?
Countries that have not signed on yet include Russia and China and India. Russia and China are often reluctant to sign on to major treaties, but again, it doesn't mean that they won't be affected by its provisions. Importantly, we have seen many of the world's largest arms exporters have signed the treaty. The United States signed at this time last year. Many of the major arms exporters from Europe, the UK, France, Spain, Italy, Germany have all signed and ratified. And emergent arms exporters like South Africa, Mexico, Brazil are also amongst the signatories.
Anna McDonald is director of the Control Arms Coalition. From New York, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. This is day three of the 69th session of the UN General Assembly. The first of today's speakers was Namibian President Hifikepunye Pohamba. He raised concerns about ongoing conflicts in Africa.
We remain concerned about the political instability and the armed conflict in South Sudan, Somalia, Mali, and the Central African Republic. However, the success achieved by the government of DRC, MONUSCO, and the SADC Intervention Brigade in neutralizing the negative forces in the eastern part of DRC is encouraging. In order to further consolidate peace, the voluntary disarmament, demobilization, repatriation, resettlement and the reintegration program for the negative forces must be implemented fully. Mr. President, Namibia supports the participation of women in peacekeeping and peace building operations around the world. In this context, we call for the full implementation of the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1325 on women, peace and security.
Namibian President Hifikepunye Pohamba speaking today at the United Nations. Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara also spoke today through an interpreter. He warned of threats to Africa, including terrorism.
From the Horn of Africa to the Sahelo-Saharan area, the explosion of maritime piracy, various types of criminal trafficking, and more recently, the resurgence of pandemics such as the Ebola hemorrhagic fever, which has been ravaging certain countries in West Africa, are threatening the African contract and risk making it lose a decade of human progress and economic growth. Contrary to the wars of yesteryear, these transborder threats in the long term will spare no state and no region. This is why we need to face this collectively. Present international mobilization against terrorism and extremism is most positive. It would win, however, by being expanded to Africa in order to sustainably destroy terrorist movements which are now active at the doors of Europe. Africa must not be the forgotten continent in the struggle against terrorism.
That was Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara speaking through an interpreter. Guinea's President Alpha Conde also spoke to the General Assembly today. The West Africa Ebola outbreak originated in his country. Mr. Conde, through an interpreter, talked about the epidemic.
It is my duty here to raise with you the issue of the serious health and humanitarian crisis Guinea and other states of the Western African subregion are now facing. As you are aware, the Ebola hemorrhagic fever virus has been threatening international security. Since its emergence in March 2014, it has caused more than 2,500 victims and continues to claim lives. The negative impact of the Ebola hemorrhagic virus and fever on national economy was shown through the slowdown in commercial trade, a drop in productivity, and a decline in activities in the sectors of transportation, investment, and tourism. At the present stage, Guinea has had a loss of nearly 2.5% on planned GDP growth. This loss could increase unless appropriate measures are not taken in time to stem the epidemic. Other adverse consequences are also looming over the affected countries, in particular the closure of borders and the free movement of peoples, the suspension of flights, and the stigmatization of nationals of the states affected by this illness. The Ebola epidemic recalls to us the vital need of a global approach to contain and conquer this terrible illness. We need to combat the irrational panic which has taken over the world. Ebola is a highly serious epidemic, but it can be healed and it is not necessarily a death sentence.
That was Guinea's President Alpha Conde speaking through an interpreter at the United Nations. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's coming up on 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Nyama Karoma, the First Lady of Sierra Leone, speaks to VOA on the Ebola crisis.
I would want the people in West Africa to know that Ebola is real. Ebola kills. Early detection and prompt treatment can save lives. And I'm asking our people not to victimize or stigmatize survivors. Ebola is a challenge, but together we'll all be able to overcome it.
That was Sia Nyama Karoma, the First Lady of Sierra Leone, speaking to VOA Africa on the Ebola crisis.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Public health specialists worry that fear of Ebola in West Africa will prevent people from getting treatment for malaria. And Ghana has been riding a wave of progress in the healthcare field with their national health insurance scheme. Coming up, music from Nigeria, and our feature reports will be coming up as well. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're beginning this evening with women's basketball.
Kim, let's begin with women's basketball.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
The 17th FIBA Basketball World Championship for Women tips off Saturday in Turkey. Angola and Mozambique will be dribbling the ball for Africa at the 16-team tournament. Let's take a quick look at their opening games on Saturday. Angola will go against Serbia in Istanbul, while Mozambique will meet Canada in Ankara. On Thursday night, I appeared via Skype on Nigeria's Channels Television on their Sports Tonight show. My friend Toyin Ibitoye asked me about the USA team in Turkey, and I told Toyin the American girls have to be considered a favorite for the gold medal. They're both the reigning world and Olympic champion in women's basketball. However, as I mentioned to Toyin, France, which lost to the USA by 36 points in the 2012 Olympic gold medal game in London, recently proved that the American girls are beatable. 5 days ago, France edged the USA 76-72 in an exhibition game played in Paris. It was the first loss for the USA women's team since 2011, when they were beaten by the Czech Republic. And I want to give a Sunny Side of Sports shout out for two of the veteran players on the USA women's team in Turkey, Sue Bird and Diana Taurasi, who both play professionally in the Women's National Basketball Association, or WNBA. I met Bird at the 2012 London Olympics. She's a three-time Olympic champion, and she's the first American player to be named to four, count them, four USA World Championship teams. Meanwhile, Diana Taurasi recently won her third WNBA title with the Phoenix Mercury, a five-time WNBA scoring champion. Diana also was named Most Valuable Player of the WNBA Finals earlier this month. Her Mercury club swept the Chicago Sky 3-0. The USA women's team will begin defense of its world title on Saturday when they play China in Istanbul, Turkey.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
This is Dikembe Mutombo. I am from Africa. Malaria kills thousands of children every day. Don't let your child be one of them. Make sure they sleep under a treated mosquito net. Beating malaria is like winning at basketball. You need to get to the net.
You need to get to the net, thanks to Dikembe. Joining us once again from Johannesburg is our African football guru, David Legg. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Sammy, and good evening to all the football lovers around the continent.
David, if you can open your mailbag now, any interesting comments recently from our Voice of America listeners?
Yes, Sonny, the mails keep coming in, and one that I was particularly interested in was from Paul Olise, and as his name suggests, he's a great Nigerian football fan. And Paul's question is very straightforward. He says that I should elaborate on why CAF ranks Ivory Coast ahead of Nigeria. Now, let me just quickly explain to Paul that, of course, it's FIFA that do these rankings from the results that come in. And in all fairness, Paul, Ivory Coast, they've been doing better lately than Nigeria. I know they lost heavily in Cameroon, but they did beat Sierra Leone. Nigeria, on the other hand, have made a poor start to the Cup of Nations qualifiers, beaten at home by Congo Brazzaville and held away by South Africa, a team they normally wallop. If we look at the rankings, Sonny, the top 10, Algeria are first, Ivory Coast are second, Tunisia are third, Ghana fourth, and Senegal fifth. Nigeria, the defending African champions, are sixth. Well done to the Cape Verde Islands. More about them in a minute. They're seventh. Cameroon, eighth. Guinea, nine. And Burkina Faso, 10. Now, Cape Verde have risen a staggering 33 places. And obviously, that's got a lot to do with their away win over Niger and their home win over Zambia in Cup of Nations qualifiers. On the other hand, Egypt, down in 13th place, they have plummeted 23 positions. And again, I believe the reason, pretty straightforward. They lost away to Senegal and at home to Tunisia in Cup of Nations qualifiers. A little bit sad to see Sierra Leone, Sonny. They're down 25 places. And again, it's the Nations Cup results. Because of Ebola, they can't play matches at home. They lost in Ivory Coast. And then what should have been a home game against DR Congo turned into an away fixture, and they lost that as well. Another side rising considerably are Congo Brazzaville. They're in 11th place. They've risen 30 positions, and the reason for that is, once again, Paul, if you're listening, obvious. They won in Nigeria, and then they won at home to Sudan. I mentioned the top 10, Sonny. Let me quickly run through 11 to 20. 11 is Congo, 12 Mali, 13 Egypt, 14 South Africa, 15 Libya, 16 DR Congo, 17 Sierra Leone, 18 Benin, 19th Uganda, and 20th Gabon. VOA!
David, if our VOA listeners have a football-related question for you, can you give us your email address?
Yes, certainly, Sonny. It's david.leg, and leg is spelled L-E-G-G-E. At AFP, that's Agence France Presse, .com. So I'll just repeat that one more time. It's david.leg, L-E-G-G-E, at AFP.com. And we'd love to hear from you.
We would love to hear from our listeners. So if you have a question for David, soccer or football related, please send it to him and we will try to read your question on the air.
Voice of America!
I'm Shegu Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game.
Game on, VOA sports fans. Just ahead, VOA's Downtown Brown will have our English Premier League football question of the week.
Hey, this is VOA's Downtown Brown, and I'm back again with question of the week. The question was, do you think Diego Costa will top the 27 league goals he scored when he played for Spain's Atletico Madrid last season? We had a well amount of responses who gave great opinions to tell you, like Ebenezer Michael Diversion from Nigeria, who said, fingers crossed, but it seems most likely. And Shobego De Stryker from Nigeria also, who said, I'm a diehard Chelsea fan, and I see Diego Costa scoring more than 28 goals if he remains fit. And a lot of other people who responded to the question said the same thing. If he remains fit and healthy, he can achieve it. In the 5 games he played so far, he has already scored 7 goals. Soccer news. The famous Cristiano Ronaldo scored 4 goals in a single match over the weekend, which gives him 7 goals so far. Manchester City lost 5-3 to Leicester City with a 3-1 goal lead. And games to watch over the weekend: Liverpool versus Everton, Chelsea versus Aston Villa, Arsenal versus Tottenham. And check your local listings for the time. Injured news. Ramirez from Chelsea injured his groin, and we'll keep you up to date on the recent injuries and stories on facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Soccer news. Remember the date. Remember it. October 25th is when Real Madrid is playing against Barcelona. Check your local listings for the time. That's all the time I have. Thanks for leaving your comments. And be sure to catch our question of the week on Tuesday on facebook.com/VOA Sunny. I'm VOA's Downtown Brown. And that's the sunny side of sports.
Turning to athletics, USA Track and Field has submitted a bid to make the northwestern U.S. city of Eugene, Oregon, one of 3 contenders to host the 2019 IAAF World Championships. The 2 other cities bidding to stage the World Championships are Doha, Qatar, and Barcelona, Spain. The International Association of Athletics Federations, or IAAF, is scheduled to announce the winner on November 18th. The United States has never hosted the competition. Eugene was the venue for the IAAF's World Junior Championships in July. It's also, along with New York City, one of the 2 American stops on the IAAF's Diamond League circuit. The USA's Olympic Committee Chief Executive Scott Blackman told Reuters that having the World Championships in Eugene would help build the sport of athletics in the USA, and he's very hopeful the IAAF will look favorably on the bid. Reuters reports that Eugene will need to double the size of its Hayward Field Stadium to win the bid. The stadium currently has an expandable seating capacity of about 21,000. The report says Eugene will also have to secure more housing to win the event. According to the Oregonian newspaper, the IAAF says organizers of the World Championships need to be ready to accommodate 2,000 athletes from more than 200 countries, as well as 10,000 officials and volunteers and 3,000 members of the media. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays like today, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, Liberia's government takes a different approach in educating people on the Ebola virus. And 20 years after its birth in a video shop in Lagos, Nollywood is one of the most prolific film producers. First, let's take a music break. Here's Clout 7 of Nigeria with Beautiful Women. I'm gonna go Cloud 7 of Nigeria with Beautiful Women. Well, in the country suffering the highest number of Ebola deaths, Liberia's government has learned something about trying to contain the virus. On a peninsula called West Point, the government met with violence when they quarantined the frightened and poverty-stricken shantytown with armed guards. Then they tried health education outreach without even saying the word Ebola. VOA's Anne Look reports from Monrovia, where health volunteers are looking for sick people.
A brief celebration amid all the sickness and death. 12 Ebola survivors are released from the government-run Elwa 2 treatment unit. Deputy Health Minister Tolbert Ninsua says they are making progress every day in Monrovia. But
the fact is that transmission is still going on. I am not saying that transmission has been broken, no. I cannot deceive the world.
Liberia must outflank the virus. Health volunteers have started doing rounds in the West Point shantytown. They don't use the word Ebola.
Okay, we are here on health matters, We want to know as to whether you have any sick person, somebody suffering from malaria, fever, typhoid, pressure, any of that thing. No one is sick.
You're not sick.
All the children well?
It's the height of the malaria and typhoid season, and those people need care. But Ebola also has similar symptoms. Suspected cases must be found and taken to isolation.
No.
The team hears there may be someone sick near the mosque, so they head that way. Is anyone sick here, they ask. Has anyone died recently?
If anybody died here recently, we'll let you people know. We don't have no patient here.
I'm not talking about patient per se. Those who are experiencing malaria, fever, headache, shopping. Okay, these are things, information we want.
Yes, sir.
Mother.
Two houses away, there's a sick girl. She's had fever and vomiting. They add her to their list. They say a response team will follow up, but no one seems to know who will come or when. Back at the area's health center, the waiting room is near empty. Staff say people are scared to come, scared it may be contaminated or that they may be taken to isolation. Contact tracers deliver their reports. They have just visited about 150 people related to 30 suspected Ebola victims. Supervisor Marie Hiding says these daily follow-ups are chipping away at resistance.
Because when you see somebody going to your house every day, oh, how are you coming on? Are you sick today? No. You know, and they will be happy to see us because they will know that we are care for them and we are concerned.
The government lifted the quarantine on West Point on August 30th. Authorities barricaded the area after a mob attacked this holding center for suspected Ebola patients on August 17th. The quarantine led to panic and was criticized as counterproductive. Government spokesman Lewis Brown defends it.
There was a level of denial that needed, in our mind, shock therapy. People needed to be sort of awakened to the fact that, look, this is deadly and it is serious. And this is no hanky-panky business.
But as resistance fades, another challenge is amplified. Where can sick people go? Ebola treatment units in the capital are full. Doctors Without Borders is expanding this unit to add 280 beds. Other agencies are building 5 more units to open later this month. And look, VOA News, Monrovia.
Well, 20 years after its birth in a video shop in Lagos, Nollywood is one of the most prolific film producers. Despite low budgets and whirlwind production schedules, Nigerian films are wildly popular in Africa. Industry professionals say they hope future films will be as great in quality as they are in quantity. Heather Murdoch has more from Lagos.
Action. As a generator hums on the roof, director F. Olu Michaels shoots his 14th episode of Remember Me, a soap opera about a girl with magical powers. He says since he got into the business 16 years ago, Nollywood has grown from a ragtag industry into a giant, producing thousands of films a year.
It has changed a lot. People, bad jobs don't really make waves anymore. If you don't do a good job, you are nowhere. Bad jobs just die along the line, but good jobs are recommended and people keep talking about it.
But Nollywood also suffers from the same woes as the rest of Nigeria: widespread poverty, insecurity, and lack of electricity. As a result, Nigerian artists say their movies are made on tight budgets and films lack polish. At a fancy country club in Lagos, Olu Jacobs, one of Nollywood's most famous actors, says many movies are shot in only a week for less than $30,000.
We haven't got the money to prolong it for more than 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 days maximum. Otherwise, you run out of money.
But he says Nollywood movies are popular because they reflect themes Africans can relate to, instead of Hollywood's version of the continent, an exotic land of large wild animals and suffering villagers.
I am an eternal optimist. I will tell you that Nollywood is going to improve by leaps and bounds. You know, because more and more people and organizations are beginning to see that this field is respected outside this country.
Back on the set of Remember Me, where the generator is still the only source of power, 21-year-old actress Bronze Manuals says Nollywood gives young Nigerian artists a chance to make it.
It's about the passion. It's about how much effort you can put into it. That's how I see it.
This is Manuel's first role after many auditions, but she says she does not want to be just another actress. She wants to be a Nollywood star. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Lagos.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Rape is often used as a tactic of war, intentionally terrorizing and brutalizing entire communities. And although women and girls are by far the most common victims, men and boys are also frequently assaulted. Given that the legacy of sexual violence and conflict can cause long-term instability, addressing impunity is part of the process for restoring peace. The scourge of sexual violence in conflict has been identified by the United Nations as a matter of acute and urgent concern, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Samantha Power. Neither the fog of war nor the associated breakdown of law provide any explanation or excuse for actions that violate the rights and disrespect the fundamental dignity of human beings. Working through the United Nations Security Council, the international community has repeatedly stated that sexual violence will not be tolerated. But much more needs to be done if we are to stamp out such criminal behavior. Where sexual violence occurs because the government is weak, the international community must do more to help local institutions develop responses, including access to justice and support for survivors. That's because governments have a duty to protect and promote the rights of citizens. Every government should have or establish laws, develop institutions, and pursue policies that protect from sexual violence all of its people, regardless of gender, social, or economic status. It is very important that every government take steps to ensure that the stigma of sexual violence no longer bedevils the survivors, including male survivors, as is too often the case. Instead, it is time to affirm that guilt and stigma fall on the shoulders of the perpetrators. In far too many countries, the victims of sexual violence still have little, if any, effective legal recourse. Until that changes, predators will not be deterred, survivors will hesitate to come forward, and justice will remain beyond reach, said Ambassador Power. Sexual abuse is inflicted out of cruelty and robs people of the right to life, liberty, and security of person. Still, for far too long, it has been treated as part of the spoils of victory. That must end. The government and the people of the United States strongly support a concerted strategy across the globe to address this scourge, both in peace and war.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight, comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.